Welcome to Deloitte IFRS University Consortium Virtual Symposium. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After the presentation, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. To ask a question, please press star 1. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'll turn the meeting over to Mr. DJ Gannon.
Thank you very much. And on behalf of Deloitte and our consortium and our foundation, I'd like to welcome everyone to today's symposium. We've got a fair amount of material I want to get through, but very much appreciate your attendance here today. There'll be plenty of opportunity, hopefully, to ask questions along the way, both via the live meeting format as well as in terms of live questions as well. A couple of points before we get started here. In terms of materials, hopefully you've had a chance to see not only some of the materials that we have posted to our consortium website. There's a number of things that we're going to talk about today that tie back to those materials. There are some updated materials as well that you should have that were sent out yesterday that we're going to cover too. But there's a fair amount of material that you have access to already, and we certainly encourage you to take a look at that material, and certainly if there's questions that you have more generally about that material, there's an opportunity to ask questions through the website as well in terms of general questions and so forth. In terms of today's symposium, we want to cover some course materials that we developed in concert with The Ohio State University last year. We actually have a number of materials that that we've been working through in terms of IFRS that you'll have access to. I want to actually mention some materials that have been developed in concert with Virginia Tech as well that we have posted to our website that are more geared towards intermediate accounting questions and problems. There's a link on the website to also the AAA Commons website where you can actually get more detailed information with respect to those materials as well. So there's a lot of things for you to be looking at in terms of IFRS. With that, let me actually move to our agenda here before I introduce our speakers. As I said, we have a number of things we want to cover today. Today's symposium is going to be focused on an IFRS course that we delivered to Ohio State University last year, and we are very fortunate to have with us a number of folks that were involved in that effort as well. We're going to cover various aspects of that course, not just the technical topics covered, but also the format of the course, some of the case materials, kind of how it was presented, talk about some of the components of the evaluations of the student performances, talk about some of the lessons learned, some of the improvements that are being made to that course as well, and give you a flavor for some of those experiences. Right after that part of the session, we're also going to open it up for questions as well in terms of just general questions around the course. We're then going to turn to a more detailed discussion of one of the actual case studies, and we'll get into more detail here in a minute in terms of the structure of the cases, et cetera. And we'll also give you an opportunity to ask questions after that discussion as well. So I certainly encourage you to ask questions. There'll be plenty of opportunity to do so. With that, let me introduce today's presenters. Besides myself, and again, I'm DJ Gannon. I'm a partner with Deloitte. I'm one of our national leadership partners. I've been involved with international financial reporting standards for most of my professional career, so it's great to be here and to see kind of how this issue was taken off here in the U.S. We're also pleased to be joined today with two other presenters, Pat Turner. Pat is a senior lecturer at The Ohio State University. He, I guess, was a guinea pig in terms of this effort. We first developed this concept of a course, and Pat was gracious to volunteer to be involved, and has done a great job in terms of facilitating the course itself. He's going to be talking about that in terms of some of the experiences that he had in his perspective, in terms of more from a professor perspective, in terms of what can be done to improve the course as well. So we're very pleased to have Pat with us here today. Also very pleased to have with us one of my partners, Kathy Bug. Kathy, I've known Kathy for a number of years. She's been heavily involved in international accounting over the years as well, and served in a variety of roles within the firm. She works with me now in what's called a project management office, which is essentially a group with a firm that is dealing with IFRS implementation in the United States. So Kathy's been very involved in terms of academic interface. She's made a number of presentations at other universities. Was heavily involved actually with the Ohio State work, and frankly, without Kathy, we would not have had a course. So she'll be also working through today's course materials as well. With that, let me go ahead and turn it over to Pat to kick it off here and talk about just what the course is about and some of the lessons learned. Pat?
Thank you, DJ, and hello, everyone, and welcome to the webcast. The majority of our time today is really going to be devoted to walking through the case study materials, but prior to getting into those materials, what I'd like to spend a little bit of time doing is sharing with you the course we offered at Ohio State last spring quarter. As far as the course itself, it was offered in our Masters of Accounting program as an elective course. And from a scheduling standpoint, the only way we could actually fit it into the schedule is that we offered the class on Fridays during spring quarter, which was a bit of a challenge when you're working mostly with graduating seniors. But we're on a quarter system, so our materials were spread out over a 10-week period. And we met for, I say 4 hours, but we were bringing in lunch, so probably lost about 20 minutes or so with that. So just from a timing standpoint, that's roughly what we were meeting on a weekly basis. Now, you will see when we look at the materials and the sessions that we had, it's obviously laid out over a 10-week period, but I think that that can easily be modified by dividing up the topics a little bit differently to accommodate a semester system. In terms of the resources that we used for the course, we did not use a textbook for this course. Our resource materials consisted of the IFRS standards that were available online, EFIRS, and we had access to those materials through IAAER. And if you're really looking for a very cost-effective approach, I would consider using those materials. I think it cost our students $20 per student, and I think for a faculty member it's $25. Very good online systems that gives you complete access to all of the IFRS materials. Our students also used the FARS online system as their frame of reference or source of reference when they were looking at US GAAP. The course itself was primarily a lecture approach, but it was supplemented heavily with case study, which I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. The great benefit, I think, of the case study is it gave the students an opportunity to immediately turn around and apply what they had learned with a real live company's set of financial statements. We did have substantial support from Deloitte in that they did provide expert speakers on the various IFRS topics, and they also developed the case study materials. So we had quite a bit of support in getting this off the ground. You can see the various topical areas that we covered, and you might look at this and say, well, that's an awfully aggressive a schedule, and it is, but actually it worked out very well, and there is really not much I would change in terms of the content when I think about offering this course again this year. In a few minutes, though, I will comment on certain changes that I'm planning on making in offering the course for the current year. One of the things I'd like to emphasize is that I don't view this course as being just a differences course. We really did teach the IFRS standards. The lectures in the course covered 21 of the international standards, and the students were required to read all of those standards as part of their preparation for the weekly classes. Yes, we did discuss the differences between IFRS and US GAAP, but that was typically something that we discussed at the end of each of the lectures. The focus really was on understanding what the IFRS standards required. Let me talk a little bit about the case studies. The approach we used is that I divided the class up into, I believe we ended up with 7 teams. And so the projects that they did were team-based projects. They were each provided a set of financial statements that they worked with throughout the quarter. And those financial statements were actual financial statements that had been filed with the SEC by foreign registrants, representing different countries and representing different industries. And actually the statements that we used and what is currently on the symposium website, you might have noticed, are what we would consider to be scrubbed financial statements, and that special effort was made to try to conceal the identity of the company. Other than that, the financial statements were pretty much left as it is, other than the fact that we did do some shortening of footnotes if we felt that they weren't relevant to the learning objectives. And the other thing that we did is to pull out the IFRS to US GAAP reconciliation because we were using that as part of our final project, which I'll talk about here in a few minutes. In terms of the weekly assignments that the students had, as I mentioned, we had weekly lectures on the various topics. The students were also required to read the IFRS standards relating to the topical areas that we covered that week. What they were then required to do is that they had to go back to their company's set of financial statements. And they had to review their company's financial statements, and based on their reading of those financial statements and the applicable footnotes and looking at the financial statement presentation, had to consider a couple of different things. First of all, sort of make an assessment as to what thought that the company was complying with the IFRS requirements, and also, very importantly, what we had them do is to identify things that they saw in those statements, which they identified as being differences between IFRS and U.S. GAAP. And we had them be pretty broad in looking at these things. There are certain items that when you see it in the footnotes of financial statements, it's very clear that this is definitely a difference between what we would do under U.S. GAAP versus what is done under IFRS. In other cases, it's not so clear that perhaps the footnote wording is not specific enough and for you to be able to make a determination as to whether there is or isn't a difference, so we had them capture those kinds of things as potential differences. After having analyzed their company's financial statements, they were then required to do team presentations where they would summarize the results of their findings, and then they also had to subject themselves to Q&A from the other members of the class and myself as well. In terms of the final assignment, we then passed out to the students that IFRS-US GAAP reconciliation that we had withheld initially. And their challenge at that point was is that they then had to go through that reconciliation, and they had to get up in front of the class and be able to articulate it. So they did a presentation to explain the various items that made up the reconciliation of going from IFRS to U.S. GAAP. As far as the way, how I went about evaluating the students in this class, I did not give a midterm and I didn't give a quiz. Each week I would give quizzes over the topical areas that we covered for that particular week. So that was part of the components of the student evaluation. Also, the teams each made 9 presentations, because weekly they were making a presentation. And since the case study projects were team-based projects, I also had the students do peer evaluations of their fellow team members, evaluating the extent which they contributed to the overall success of the team. And then I also reserved for myself a participation component of the grade as well. So those are basically the components that I used in coming up with a final grade for the students. Some thoughts now. Looking back on the experience of having taught this course last year, first of all, I was very pleased with the way the course did go. The students were very excited about the course. They were really liked the interactive format where we had the lecture and they immediately had the opportunity to turn around and work with a live set of financial statements and come back and present their findings. And this is with a Master's of Accounting group of students, but I think this would work equally well at the undergraduate level, but my recommendation would be that we would target students that are probably about at the graduating senior level, because you would want them to have a sufficient background on U.S. GAAP, or else you're going to spend an inordinate amount of time, I think, explaining U.S. GAAP before you could ever get over to IFRS. But I do think it would apply equally well in the undergraduate program with that one caveat. Other things that I'm going to be changing for this year. Last year, we worked with 7 sets of financial statements, and quite frankly, from a course administration standpoint, I found it very difficult to be familiar enough with 7 complete sets of financial statements. You have now seen how detailed those financial statements are, and you can imagine some of the detailed types of questions that students would come back about. So I found it a bit too challenging for myself to try to get my arms around 7 sets of financial statements and manage students through that process. So what I'm thinking about doing this year is limiting it more to 2 sets of financial statements, and half of the teams would work with 1 set of financial statements, half of the teams would work with another set of financial statements. Also, something we are going to do is to work with the most recent set of financial statements available. If you looked at the financial statements on the symposium website, I think for the most part, the most recent year might have been 2005, and that was done for a very specific reason at the time, because one of the things that we were doing with the course initially, a lot of companies had obviously recently changed over because of the European community switching over to IFRS. There were a lot of companies that were filing for the first time. And certainly there were some benefits in looking at those first-time filings in that you had the IFRS conversion footnote, which showed how they reconciled from whatever their local GAAP was to IFRS. So you had you were able to be able to see that information and then sort of transition into the IFRS statements. And, of course, we had the reconciliation at the end of those statements. And, of course, now, depending on which company you pick, there probably will not be that reconciliation since it's no longer required for foreign registrants if they're following IFRS. The other change that I'm looking at making this year, which was sort of a logical change to make, and in fact I'm not even sure the FARS online would be available anymore, but we'd be switching over to use the FASB codification as the source of U.S. GAAP, since that really is going to be the only source of authoritative literature by the time these students will be graduating, so we're going to transition over to it. That, in a nutshell, I guess, is what we did at a high estate and sort of where we were thinking about going from here. I think our next step then would be to move on to the case study materials. DJ, I don't know whether you wanted to open it up to questions before we do that or...
Sure. Thank you, Pat, for that overview here. Let me just see, operator, if you could open it up for any live questions. If we have a couple, we're happy to take them. If not, we can move on. But let's go ahead and open it up to see if there are any questions.
Thank you. At this time, to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your touch-tone phone. Please unmute your line and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce your question. To withdraw your request, please press star followed by two. Once again, please press star one at this time to ask a question.
One quick point while we're waiting for any questions to come in. I think we mentioned before, we've posted to the consortium website a variety of materials that include lecture notes, which were based on transcriptions of each of the lecture sessions. You can have access to those along with a PowerPoint slide deck to guide you through that particular topic. We actually have, obviously, the seven cases that we had spoke from last year, as Pat talked about. Those are based on the 05 financial statements, which at the time, I think, again, made some sense based on what we were trying to communicate with first-time adoption, et cetera. Those are still will still be posted. We are going to probably post some updated case materials for two of the seven companies, and we're going to present one of them for you here today, and we'll have one more that we'll be working on as well. So you'll have access to not only the case materials that we actually facilitated at the time, but also you'll have access to the updated materials, if you will, for two cases that that we'll be talking about. So any questions come in?
I'm showing no questions at this time.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and move on. And certainly, if you have questions, we'll have an opportunity to ask questions here at the end as well. Let me ask Kathy here to tee up for us at least kind of the case materials, and then we'll get into more of a detailed discussion of the actual components of those cases. Kathy?
Great. Thanks, DJ. Again, I'd like to welcome everybody, and it is a pleasure to be here. I did spend quite a bit of time working with Pat on the development and delivery of the course material, and like Pat said, I think we got some great lessons and figured out things that we would want to do a little bit differently or do a little bit, you know, maybe better to improve the course. One thing Pat mentioned is that originally we sort of scrubbed the identity of the companies, and the point, you know, or the thought process being that way that the students couldn't just necessarily go look at the reconciliation. In hindsight, I don't think that is actually necessary. As we go through the materials, as we go through the case study here for Pharma Group and the company's actual name, it is Sanofi Aventis. In the materials that we sent out and that we're going to walk through today, are there real financial statements? We did not try to hide the identity, But some of the concern was that, you know, the students might go look for the reconciliation and then just sort of, you know, be able to talk about those differences. As you walk through these cases, you'll notice a lot of things, and we'll point out where things might be a potential difference. It may or may not be a difference. It could possibly be a difference, but not material, and might not actually be reflected in the gap reconciliation. Because of that, I don't think the worry that they just go look at the gap reconciliation, it was probably a bit unwarranted. And I think if in fact the students are only presenting items that actually exist in the gap reconciliation, then they probably haven't gotten the gist of all the materials, because part of the effort in understanding that, you know, IFRS and the differences between U.S. GAAP are things that are potential differences. So what we're going to actually walk through Pharma Group, and that's actually going to be it's Sanofi Aventis, and it's the 2007 financial statements. But just real quick here on the slides, you know, kind of the breakout of Pharma Group is that they really have the way their footnotes work is Note A is sort of an overview and basis of presentation. Where we're going to focus most of our time today is actually on Note B, the significant accounting policies. Note C happened to be their alliances. There wasn't a lot there. And then Note D is sort of what I would consider the detailed notes, you know, the expanded roll forwards in detail. And a lot of the things that we identified in there really are just sort of the manifestation of the detail of something that was identified in the policy notes. So there are, you know, as we go through the financials, there are things identified in Note D. We're probably not focused too much on them because they will likely be covered through our discussion of you know, potential differences in Note B. If we move ahead, we've also given for you some slides. I'm going to jump ahead of these detailed notes. Really, what these slides are designed for you is to kind of help you tie back this case, this particular set of financial statements, to where it was taught in the course. So if you've downloaded the PowerPoint presentations for the various sessions, in this case, you know, Note D1 talks about business combinations, and you can see, well, it's sort of a cross-reference back that you know, the relevant standard is IFRS 3, and in fact, we happen to have covered that in Session 3 of the Ohio State, you know, at the Ohio State course. So really, all this is meant to be a sort of a mapping exercise for you to kind of take you back to where the materials were presented as part of the Ohio State course. So we've kind of gone through the notes here and kind of allocated them back to the various sessions. And then when we jump ahead, we've done this for each session, kind of the highlight the important parts of the financial statements. So we're not going to walk through it in this regard. What we decided, and I think the better way to go, is to kind of walk through the financial statements front to back. But this is sort of meant to be a takeaway for you to kind of, we'll say, bridge the case study back to the course lecture material, which is available to you on the consortium website. So with that, I think I'm going to turn it back to DJ, and we'll kind of jump into the detailed case study.
Okay. Thank you, Kathy. And I guess what we're going to do here, hopefully you have a chance to follow along here. We're going to actually walk through what was sent out, I believe, yesterday in an email to each of you. Again, hopefully you have time to access that or have access to it now. It is the 2007 financial statements, and what we want to do is just kind of focus on those financial statements. I'm going to start out with the first couple of things, and then we're just going to kind of go back and forth across Pat, me, and Kathy, and walk through the various parts of the financial statements, highlighting certain things to raise in terms of the lectures, in terms of the case material discussions, if you will. And then once we get through that, we will open it up for questions in terms of anything we've talked about here today, or more generally as well. So with that, let me start out here with just the basic financial statements. If you actually look at these financials, you've got about 100 or so pages, so it is a fairly lengthy document. A lot of this stuff obviously will look and feel a lot like what you're used to seeing in terms of U.S. GAAP disclosures, et cetera. What I want to start highlighting here, if you go to the basic financial statements, we talk about the balance sheet, and I guess before we get into the specifics here, a couple of general points to be mindful of that we did highlight in terms of the lecture materials. And that is, I think that as you go through these financial statements, you're going to notice a couple of big picture differences. One's going to be terminology differences. There's certainly words and phrases that you'll recognize, but you may not realize that there could be a different meaning under IFRS. The term probable, for example, doesn't mean the same thing under IFRS as it does under U.S. GAAP. There are going to be some new terms, things like associates, which means an equity method investee. So certainly pointing out, and this goes back to what Pat was saying earlier, this is not just a differences course, it's also trying to teach what IFRS is, the lingo, the terminology, the general principles. And so I think it's important to note those things as you go through these cases over the course of a course. In terms of the balance sheet, again, looks and feels a lot like what we're used to seeing here in the U.S. You see the term associates here on the asset side. I think one interesting piece of this particular company's balance sheet is that they actually, while it's classified, if you look at the ordering of the items, they're actually in the opposite direction as we normally would see from a U.S. perspective, where you have the most liquid items first in terms of assets and the most current items, if you will, and you work down to the most illiquid or most non-current items. That actually is just the opposite of what you're seeing here. And I think what that demonstrates is that from an IFRS perspective, there are not really any prescribed formats. There are certainly general requirements that you have to have certain items, and those are articulated in IS-1. But in terms of flexibility around the formats, there is a fair amount, and you're going to see that come out in terms of the different cases. So as we walk through the rest of the balance sheet, again, nothing here stands out as being too different. I would point out in terms of the kind of the right side of the balance sheet, minority interest, you'll note, is included as part of equity. That actually was a difference, currently is, although that's going to go away in terms of some of the recent changes to U.S. GAAP. But again, a lot of the same kinds of items you're seeing here. You'll see references here as well to detailed footnotes, which, again, ties back to some of the more detailed disclosures that we'll highlight as well. If we move on to the income statement, the performance statement, here I think you're starting to see some differences or some different types of ways of looking at things. First thing I'd note here is we do have a functional presentation format for expenses, at least in general. So we're presenting sales, cost of sales, a gross profit number, etc. One of the requirements under IFRS that actually has been a bit of an issue in practice is that if you have this type of format, you're also required to disclose what's called the nature of your expenses. And so you're having to then take the nature of those expenses and show them how they were essentially allocated across the different functions. So you're allocating things like employee costs and benefit costs, maybe depreciation, et cetera, across your different functional lines. And that is something certainly to highlight and watch out for as well. One of the practice issues I mentioned was that those disclosures were not overly evident in financial statements, in filings that we looked at, and that information typically would be in multiple footnotes versus in one place. And so, again, kind of pointing out the clarity of disclosures, I think, is a very important part of this as well, and the way people approach these different different ways of disclosing things. Other issue I would note here is this notion of individual performance measures, obviously a big issue in practice. From a U.S. reporting perspective, SEC rules prohibit what are so-called non-GAAP measures. So you have to follow the prescribed formats in a regulation SX if you're a public company. If you're a private company, you have a little flexibility there, I suppose. But if you're a public company, very rigorous prescribed formatting pursuant to SEC rules. That does not exist with respect to IFRS. So you're going to see a lot more individual subtotaling items in an income statement, for example. What's interesting about this particular income statement here is if you were to look at the original income statement in 05, there was some different nomenclature around some of the operating income subtotals. And one of the big issues the SEC staff had commented on was clarity around those subtotals and making sure that users understood kind of what was either included or excluded from those various subtotals. And you can see on here you've got an operating income subtotal that it actually is before what I call the bad stuff, things like restructuring charges, et cetera, impairments. Then we have those items, and we have what is referred to as just plain run-of-the-mill operating income. So those are the kind of things, again, I would tend to highlight in terms of potential differences that you may see, and certainly challenge the student to think through, you know, what makes sense. Is it clear what the items are? One other thing I'd point here that would be a little bit of a difference in terms of presentation is how we approach the minority interest in the allocation of income to those shareholders. From a U.S. reporting perspective, you typically would have it as an expense, if you will, that is deducted from income to get you to a net income that would be allocated to the majority shareholders. Here, and this is a requirement under IFRS, is you've got your total net income, then you actually allocate that income across majority and minority shareholders. So, again, something to highlight there as well in terms of the general presentation format. If we move on to the cash flow statement, again, a lot of similarity in terms of the category. Certainly, you have operating category, investing, financing, very similar to Statement 95 in the U.S. There are some things, not so much in terms of this particular statement, but in practice, there's a lot more flexibility to allocate certain types of items across the different presentation format, different classifications, operating, investing, financing. A good example would be income taxes or dividends or interest. U.S. GAAP, those typically are going to be operating items under IFRS. You could actually allocate those across different categories. So that wasn't done in this particular context, but certainly is something to watch out for in terms of a potential difference. But I would say in terms of the cash flow statement, a lot more similarities there. You'll notice here they're using the indirect method, which of course is permitted, as well as the direct method under IFRS, just like under U.S. GAAP. If you go to note D17, which is referred to here, it's very interesting. There's a discussion. This is in the context of changes in borrowing amounts, both on a short-term and long-term basis. Note D17 has a fair amount of discussion about this notion of net debt, which is actually a performance measure you see quite a bit of in Europe, which is looking at things like cash, cash equivalents, other short-term assets, as it relates to borrowings, both on a short-term and long-term basis. And there's actually a lot of discussion. There's probably 2, 3, 4 pages in note D17 that talk about net debt. So it's kind of interesting. You don't necessarily see those kinds of disclosures from a U.S. perspective, because it's not a measure we typically look at. So those are the kind of things that you may want to point out in terms of different differences in disclosures with respect to IFRS. If we go to the next statement, which is the statement of changes, actually this is the kind of the version of comprehensive income. It's called the statement of recognized income and expenses. SARI is the acronym that we use for that. And again, looks and feels much like what you're used to seeing in the U.S. in terms of comprehensive income. We have all of the items that are recognized outside income, but in equity, things like changes in fair value for certain types of financial assets and liabilities, certain hedging effects would be in there. We've got things like actuarial gains and losses. Again, very similar to what you're used to seeing from a U.S. GAAP presentation format. One thing the IFRS currently allows is if you do this format, you don't have to. You actually have different, either a one-step or two-step statement coupled with a statement of changes in equity. If you notice here, actually, in one of the notes, it's notes D15, they actually have a full-blown statement of changes in equity. So you have to go back to the notes to actually see that, and that looks and feels much like what you're used to seeing from a U.S. perspective as well. So in terms of the basic financial statements, again, probably a lot more similarities in terms of these particular financial statements that you would just notice. But again, as I said, there's a number of things, questions to pose to the students in terms of clarity and making sure that they understand kind of what the requirements are and what could change. The other thing I would note just in general in terms of the whole area of presentation, you know, some of you may be aware that there's a project that's been ongoing at the ISB for a while on presentation. A discussion paper was recently issued on that in the last year. And this is one of those convergence projects that is ongoing between the FASD and the ISD, and we're looking at possibly having changes to those standards sometime, say, by 2011. So certainly over the course of the next couple of years, you know, what we're seeing, what we're talking about now will be applicable, but recognize that down the road we are going to see some pretty fundamental changes. We're not going to get into this today, but I wanted to flag it for you as a discussion point. We are looking at seeing some potentially significant changes in the makeup of the basic financial statements in terms of their classifications, presentation formats, with this new project. So that's probably worth flagging as well. Let me now move on to just the first couple of footnotes here. If you look at the introduction footnote, again, just general information about the company, nothing that is really kind of unique to IFRS in terms of that particular note. If you go to note A, we talk about the basis of presentation, which is here. I think a couple of things I would note. One is how the company is referring to IFRS, and this goes back to certainly a lot of commentary we've had over the course of the last couple of years, really since 2005, in terms of how companies and how jurisdictions approach IFRS, and to what extent are there different versions of IFRS, and ultimately what the SEC has talked about, and certainly that's reflective here, is that companies should be referring to IFRS full stop, meaning the version of the standard that comes out of the ISD. And that's clearly what's been referred to here. That certainly is what the audit opinion also refers to as well, which is a requirement, by the way, to get the relief from not having to reconcile back to U.S. GAAP. Okay, so I think one of the trends we're going to see is if you were to look at the 05 financial statements of a lot of European companies in particular, they would be referring to IFRS as endorsed by the European Union, not IFRS as issued by the ISD. That certainly has changed over the last few years in light of this discussion, so that's certainly one thing worth highlighting. A couple other things. If you look at this note A, A2 talks about IFRS 1. IFRS 1 is the standard that talks about first-time adoption, and actually in these particular financial statements, you're not going to see much in the way of disclosure around IFRS 1 other than what's in this first footnote, mainly because IFRS 1 really only applies in that first year of adoption in terms of the general requirements on disclosures. And so what we have posted for you, which you certainly would encourage you to look at, would be all the IFRS 1 disclosures, and there's a number of them that are required in terms of when a company first-time adopts. And we've actually posted that material to you. Actually, in terms of the 05 financial statements, it was note F, actually, was the first-time adoption note. And in that note, it talks, or it has, I should say, all of the disclosures required under IFRS 1 in terms of reconciliations of things like balance sheet, the income statement for different periods. This particular company had, I think, a pretty good footnote, actually, for under IFRS 1. There's probably about a dozen or so pages, and it actually goes into a fair amount of detail in terms of the kinds of adjustments that were made going from, in this case, French GAAP to IFRS, and then, of course, having a more detailed discussion about what those adjustments were, both in the context of differences between French GAAP and IFRS, as well as IFRS 1 elections. And if I go back to the 07 financial statements here under note A2, they do talk about some of the exemptions that the company elected under IFRS 1. And what's interesting to note here is that there are a number of exemptions from retrospective application, things that you don't have to do upon adoption, that actually create differences between local GAAP and, in this case, U.S. GAAP, French GAAP, and IFRS. And in here, the company's highlighted a number of things, business combination accounting, being one, employee benefits, certain aspects of financial instrument accounting, including foreign currency accounting, where companies are able to make certain elections that would, again, create differences in terms of an opening balance sheet from local GAAP as well. So, again, noting those things, pointing them out, I think certainly is relevant to this exercise. I'm not going to go through the IFRS 1 reconciliation in detail, but I would say it's actually a pretty good reconciliation. There's a lot of good information in here that it can talk about the effective adjustments going from, in this case, French GAAP to IFRS. And obviously, as U.S. companies begin to use IFRS, that reconciliation will be in the context of going from U.S. GAAP to IFRS. If we move on to other aspects of Note A. There's also just a general discussion in A3 about new standards. That's pretty typical. It's a requirement under IS-1 that is consistent with U.S. GAAP as well. So to the extent that there are new standards that are effective but not being used or being used that are not effective yet, you would be talking about them in general context in terms of what they mean for the company. Use of estimates is the next one, which, again, pretty typical discussion that we see. And as you can see here, there are a number of areas where companies have to make estimates. And I think one of the interesting things to point out in terms of the detailed footnotes is that, in general terms, I think IFRS emphasizes the need to make a little more detailed discussion around judgments used in terms of applying standards. So things like revenue recognition, when you're making estimates, or impairment testing, provisioning. And I think that that's one of the things that it's certainly to challenge students on in terms of making sure they understand kind of what the disclosures are, but also what the requirements are and how well does the company do in terms of applying those particular requirements. If we move on to the footnote B now, which is really the bulk of what we're going to focus on here today in terms of the more detailed policies, a lot of what we would otherwise see in Note B actually may be outside the financial statements from a U.S. GAAP perspective in terms of sentencing accounting policies, that critical accounting policies that we would call it from a U.S. perspective. But nonetheless, they're required to be included in the audited financial statements from an IFRS perspective. And there are a number of areas we can point out, some of those that may be the case in general, where you're going to see more disclosure actually in the audited financial statements from an IFRS perspective versus U.S. GAAP, where you're going to have certain types of information actually included, which are actually included outside the financial statements. If we go to back to Note B here, I'm going to go through the first couple of items here and then hand it off to Pat. The first note here is just the basis of consolidation. And again, here, a couple of things that may not be overly obvious, but I wanted to highlight for you is the policy describes the basis of consolidation. It refers to the notion of control. That on the surface may seem kind of similar to U.S. GAAP, but if you understand what the control definition is, it actually results in a potential difference from IFRS or from U.S. GAAP. And the other thing I should mention here real quick is we talk about differences. Certainly we're going to highlight things that could be potential differences or potential reconciling differences, if you will. I think the important point here for the students is to understand what the different requirements are from an application perspective, and a good example would be consolidation policy. Just because there is a different requirement doesn't always mean that you're going to have a different reconciling item. In other words, you're not necessarily going to have an effect of that difference, notwithstanding the fact that there's a different requirement. And then actually, in this particular case, there is no reconciling differences in the context of consolidation policy, although it is a different requirement, which means the company ought to be looking at what the effect would be potentially on their own financial statements. Okay? In terms of Note B2, here we're talking about foreign currency. A couple of things here to note. Again, the disclosures look a lot like what you're used to seeing under U.S. GAAP. You have the notion of a functional currency, which is basically the same as it is under U.S. GAAP, although you could have some judgmental differences potentially if you were to take out a clean piece of paper and look at what your functional currency would be on that transition date. And we didn't see too much of that in practice, but I can tell you certainly that is something to watch out for in terms of potential differences in functional currency. That was not the case here, by the way. In terms of how that plays out in the financial statements, obviously you have differences in foreign currency transactions, which those effects of having transactions in different currencies other than the functional currency go to the income statement. That's consistent with U.S. GAAP. Translation differences, on the other hand, go to equity, which is, again, consistent with U.S. GAAP. If we look at Note 3, this note, interesting, this is on business combinations, and what's interesting about this one is that a lot of these differences are going to go away, actually, with some of the recent changes to the business combination literature that were promulgated last year, IFRS 3R and FAS 141R in terms of U.S. GAAP, but to highlight some of the things that applied in these financial statements as well as in the financial statements in 05, if you look at One item would be just the notion of IFRS 1 application and the fact the company was not required to go back and retrospectively apply the business combination literature prior to the date of transition. They did not do that, so they elected that election, that exemption, if you will. And so now you're going to have legacy differences between items that would have been accounted for, say, under U.S. GAAP as an acquisition that may not have been so. From an IFRS perspective upon transition. And that accounted for a number of differences, actually, in terms of the reconciling items, if you actually look at the GAAP reconciliation. In terms of goodwill accounting, again, a couple of things here to flag. Again, the function of goodwill is obviously going to be a function of assets and liabilities that you account for in terms of your purchase price allocation. You could have some differences there more generally in terms of how you measure things, and that could obviously impact the number that relates to the goodwill amount that you ultimately get to. There are some differences here which may not be overly apparent in terms of this disclosure around impairment testing for goodwill, but certainly that's something to flag as well in terms of a potential difference. Other item to flag, which is going to go away in terms of differences, is when you look at your measurement date as it relates to your purchase price determination and allocation of that price to all your assets and liabilities. Again, up until recently, that was a difference between IFRS and U.S. GAAP, different dates to measure things. And that has been conformed now in terms of the revisions to the business combination literature. I mentioned minority interest presentation differences existed here. That's gone away as well. And also what's interesting is a new difference to watch out for is actually the accounting for minority interest upon acquisition. That certainly could be a difference under the new standards that may exist. Let me move on here in terms of intangible accounting. Intangibles is one of those big areas of difference in terms of theory. There's probably a half dozen or so areas like that. Intangibles is one of them, consolidation policy I mentioned earlier. Here, again, you're not going to see anything that's going to be too evident here. One of the differences that to watch out for is in the context of intangibles and the requirement to capitalize certain development costs. We only do that in the U.S., obviously, if you have certain types of costs, namely software, potentially. But under IFRS and IAS 38, there is a broad-based requirement that companies at least assess whether or not certain development costs meet the capitalization criteria under IAS 38. And if they do, you're required to capitalize those costs. And here, actually, there was a pretty significant initial reconciling item between IFRS and U.S. GAAP for those costs. And so certainly if you're a company that does a lot of research and development, that actually is an area to watch out for in terms of difference. And you're required to, essentially, once you capitalize those costs, amortize them as well. So you'll have the ongoing differences that relate to amortization expense as well. With that, I think, I have one more, a couple more points here. In terms of acquired in-process research and development, again, kind of ties back to business combination accounting. Used to be a difference under U.S. GAAP. Obviously, we allocated purchase price to IP R&D that was acquired. We would then expense that, and so it kind of went away magically. From an IFRS perspective, you're required to capitalize those costs as you would otherwise and amortize those into the future. So that difference has been conformed, but obviously was the case here and in the earlier 05 financial statements. I would say in terms of acquired intangibles, more generally things like licenses, stuff like that, trademarks, generally you're going to have the same accounting for those items. There has been an ongoing debate over the years around how you value certain things like acquired trademarks that you don't want to use or you're not going to be using anymore, and there's been a fair amount of discussion about that at the SEC level over the course of the last few years as well in terms of this notion of a defensive value. Things like that. Again, those are the kind of things to watch out for in terms of policies and whatnot, but generally it's been conformed now. I think with that, I'm going to turn over here to Pat to talk about property, plant, equipment, a few other topics. Pat?
Okay. Well, I'm picking up on F14 on footnote B5 on property, plant, and equipment. A couple of the items that we wanted to point out to the students are things that we would expect them to pick up on in looking at this footnote. There is discussion in here about the fact that the company uses a component approach for accounting for property and depreciation. That's not typically the approach that we use here in the U.S. Typically, we just depreciate the asset over its expected service life. the entirety of the asset, whereas IFRS requires that you separate significant components and that they be recorded separately and depreciated separately. So that's one of the differences that they would have picked up here. Another subtle item here relates to the borrowing costs, and that's in the last paragraph on this page. The possibility for some differences there on the borrowing costs. There's a slight definition in difference, I guess, in definition as to what constitutes a qualifying asset, so there might be some definitional differences there. And also the IFRS definition of borrowing costs in IAS 23 includes certain ancillary costs and exchange differences on foreign currency borrowings that likewise might give rise to some differences. Typically wouldn't be elevated to the material level, but nevertheless there are some subtle differences there. Moving on to the next page, there's discussion about items that are capitalized in property, plant, and equipment pursuant to financing leases. This is where we would first bring up the issue that we really are dealing with a pretty significant difference here between the IFRS requirements and the U.S. GAAP requirements. Lease classifications under IFRS is more judgment-based, assessing whether the entity transfers substantially all the risks and rewards of ownership, whereas under U.S. GAAP, we have more of a bright line approach where we're looking at things like the 90% test and 75% test in terms of making assessments as to whether we're looking at a capitalized lease or an operating lease. But we can have some differences in classifications due to those types of changes. Also, there is discussion in this note that the company annually reviews useful lives and residual values. That's something that's actually a requirement under IFRS. That's not typically something that we would do mandatorily on an annual basis here in the U.S. In terms of impairment of property, plant, and equipment, some significant differences here that could pop out. First of all, as you know, under U.S. GAAP, we use sort of a two-step approach on measuring impairment on a long-lived asset, where we first of all do an undiscounted cash flows test, and if we fail that undiscounted cash flows test, that's when we move on to measure the impairment, looking at the differences between the carrying value and the fair value of the asset. Well, IFRS does not have that two-step approach, so there's not an undiscounted cash flows test. So you might very well have a situation where you wouldn't recognize an impairment under U.S. GAAP, but you might recognize it under IFRS, because they don't have the undiscounted cash flows test. Also, there can be potential differences as to the level at which you would do the impairment testing. For example, with goodwill or assets where you don't have specific identifiable cash flows with the particular asset, it normally gets elevated under IFRS up to looking at cash flows at the cash-generating unit level, which may or may not line up with the level that we would look at under U.S. There can be differences that arise from that as well. Moving on to the next page on F-16, and I'll move on to the B-6-3, which talks about reversals of impairments on property, plant, and equipment and intangible assets. Under IFRS, you do reverse impairments if subsequent facts and circumstances indicate that you ought to reverse the impairment that was originally recorded. We do not do that under U.S. GAAP. They don't reverse goodwill impairments, but other impairments are subject to reversals. So that's something that we would highlight for the students. I think with that, passing it back to you, DJ, to pick up on financial instruments. As much as I would love to talk about it, I'll let you know.
Sure, not a problem. I guess I got the short straw on this one here, but I'd be remiss if I didn't start out with a comment David Tweedy always talks about when he talks about financial instruments. He says, if you understand financial instrument accounting and IAS 39, you've not read the standard properly. So I think if you go through these financial statements, certainly you're going to see a lot of complexity in terms of the disclosures, very similar to what you may have experienced in terms of U.S. GAAP financial statements. What's interesting about this particular company, there actually are no reconciling items that relate to financial instrument accounting, which isn't terribly a surprise necessarily. I think a lot of this area in general, I think, is one where you certainly could make certain choices and get to a U.S. GAAP answer, if you will, if you wanted. There are other areas where you certainly can make choices and actually create differences. This particular company didn't really have any differences in terms of reconciling items, at least. There could have been things that weren't material, but you wouldn't necessarily get that from looking at the financial statements. But I wanted to kind of walk through some general points, nonetheless, in terms of this section. And there's, again, a lot of detail, not only in Note B8, but also in other notes as well in Section D. Again, we're not going to get too knee-deep in terms of this, but I wanted to flag a few issues for you in terms of points to make. In terms of just the first part of Note B, which is talking about this B1-8 financial assets, I would say that a couple of general points here is that when we're talking about financial assets, you've got, again, a various classification of items, and some of those are very similar to U.S. GAAP. Others may not be. There's different categories that you can classify financial assets as. Again, a lot of this is just a free choice. Now, there's this notion of fair value through profit and loss account, which is a relatively new concept. The fair value option, as it's coined, that's largely been conformed, although there are some nuanced differences potentially that could exist depending on how you document certain things from an IFRS versus a U.S. GAAP perspective. But by and large, the notion is the same. And so that's one category. That would include things like assets held for trading, derivatives, etc., things that would be required to be fair value to profit and loss. You also have this notion on the other end of the spectrum of assets held to maturity, which would, of course, be accounted for on a cost basis with impairment. And again, that notion is very similar under U.S. GAAP, although there are differences in terms of impairment, which I'll highlight here in a minute. In terms of two other classifications, one of which you would, well, you would actually see both of these, but in terms of U.S. GAAP, one would be available for sale securities. So if it's not through profit or loss, or if it's not held to maturity, then it would be AFS, which is that middle ground. It's where you obviously mark things to market, but the mark goes to equity, comprehensive income, not the P&L. And there are some of those securities here, again, very similar to U.S. GAAP. And the last category would be loans and receivables, which, again, you would have a loans and receivables classification of U.S. GAAP, although not in the same vein as you would here in terms of how it's teed up in terms of IAS 39 and the technical literature. And so those are the four kind of general classifications. And depending on what classification you have, obviously that drives what the subsequent measurement requirements would be. And again, in terms of first-time adoption, a company would go through and, again, determine that classification. You could have differences upon adoption in terms of what you were doing previously, and you actually saw some of that here in terms of this particular company. If you go back to the IFRS 1 reconciliation as well, but those are policy decisions that we made upon first-time adoption. If we look at other items here that come to mind, impairment testing is referred to in this particular note. This is Note B2, Note B8-2. And again, kind of a subtlety here, U.S. GAAP, obviously, you're looking at a model that's based on this notion of other than temporary impairments, and there's been a fair amount of discussion, certainly as of late, in light of some of the economic crisis issues about impairment testing and so forth. That will obviously continue into this year. But that notion isn't exactly the same under IAS 39. And again, in this particular company's case, there were no reconciling differences, although you could have some depending on how one applies the IFRS literature in terms of impairment testing. Again, it's not necessarily other than temporary concept. It's more of an indicator concept. In terms of other aspects of impairment to watch out for, again, Pat mentioned earlier the ability to reverse impairment charges. That actually would apply equally to some but not all financial items, financial assets. And so, again, you could reverse, or you're required to reverse, I should say, impairment for certain things under U.S. GAAP that you would not have that ability. Probably the most noteworthy item I would point out there would be loans and receivables, where you're required to reverse impairment charges there. Certainly an issue for things like banks and companies that have lots of loan activities. Not only the case here, but certainly a point to make. In terms of other parts of this footnote, B83 talks about this in general. A derivative is where they're classified. There's follow-on footnotes as well that have much more of a detailed discussion of the derivative activity, the kinds of derivatives the company has, and then that leads into the next footnote, which is B84 on hedging. I would say on hedging, again, a very similar notion that you would have under IFRS versus GAAP, but this is an area where there's a lot of kind of nits, if you will, in terms of potential differences around hedging. A couple of things I'll highlight for you here today. One would be upon transition is that there are documentation requirements that have to be in place before you can actually get hedge accounting. that may not always be the case under U.S. GAAP. So U.S. GAAP, you could have what's called a shortcut method, which means you don't have to go through and deal with an assessment and document that as you otherwise would. Some of the matched terms kind of concept. Under IFRS, you're required to have documentation, period. And so if you don't have documentation in place to deal with the hedging relationship and effectiveness assessments, and that includes upon transition, you don't get hedge accounted again. So a number of companies in practice actually had to deal with that, where there was no documentation in place as of the transition date, and so therefore the company, as of the transition date, did not get hedge accounting for certain relationships they otherwise would have under local GAAP. And then once that documentation and assessment was performed and documented, then of course you could have that relationship and therefore have hedge accounting, and that was actually a pretty big issue for a lot of companies in practice, and certainly something to kind of watch out for. In terms of other aspects of hedge accounting, if you just look at the general notion of hedge accounting, the kinds of hedges one could have, there's three basic kinds of hedges, a fair value hedge, managing a fair value risk, that's, again, very similar to U.S. GAAP, cash flow hedging, where you're hedging variability in cash flow streams, again, very similar requirement there. One subtle difference that could pop up, it didn't pop up here, in terms of cash flow hedging, has to do with the mechanics around once the hedged item you're talking about, it's a forecasted transaction, for example, comes on the balance sheet. The question is, what do you do with the effects of changes in value of the hedging instrument, okay, that would be recognized in equity, which is the same under both standards? What do you do with that upon bringing the asset or liability on the balance sheet, and do you adjust that basis, or do you just keep it in equity and then bringing to the income statement as needed? And IFRS allows you the ability in some cases to actually adjust the basis of the asset liability, which, again, from a P&L perspective, it's not going to matter. It's more of a balance sheet type issue there. In terms of other areas here, we also have foreign currency hedges as well. Again, very similar concept in terms of the GAAP versus IFRS. Again, nothing here pops out as being terribly different with regard to kind of the hedging section, other than the things I've mentioned as being potential differences. If we look at V8.5 in terms of financial liabilities, here again, difference in terms of it's more presentation, how we deal with presenting transaction costs, okay, which here, of course, the policy states on it's on a net basis. U.S. GAAP, we'd recognize them separately as an asset, so again, that would be a presentation difference that would pop up. In terms of fair value, note B86, again, one of those areas where being heavily debated right now in terms of the standard setting arena, obviously a lot of issues going back to the economic crisis as well with how you deal with fair value in certain instances. One of those areas where you can get similar fair values, I would say in practice, generally that is the case. Certainly with financial items it is. Non-financial items, you may have some variances there. We don't have Statement 157, at least as of yet, as part of IFRS, and so one of the things to watch out for in the next couple of years is changes in this area where the ISB is potentially going to be adopting some version of 157 in terms of fair value accounting, and I'll have a little more guidance in terms of how you go about mechanically calculating fair value, but there is no kind of exit value notion that's required, at least under IFRS, a willing buyer, willing seller concept in terms of the notion, and then obviously if you have to get into estimating fair value given your situation, then that, there could be some differences that maybe pop out there. One of the areas here that I would flag for you is when we're looking at unlisted securities, again, U.S. GAAP actually may bias you more towards cost. Under IFRS, you would actually probably have more of a fair value notion ascribed to those kinds of investments, which could create a difference, obviously, in a measurement basis. Next area I'll highlight is B87, derecognition of financial instruments. This actually is probably one of the biggest differences in the area of financial instruments, at least today, between IFRS and U.S. GAAP. the recognition of financial assets is what we're talking about here, things like factoring receivables, off-balance sheet items, if you will. Some of this ties back to the consolidation differences I alluded to earlier for setting up, for example, off-balance sheet structures, qualifying special purpose type entities, that kind of stuff, variable interest entities as we call them now under U.S. GAAP. Those are areas to watch out for as being potentially different, not just from a consolidation perspective, but also from a derecognition perspective. And again, you're not going to necessarily get this in the footnote, but in terms of the differences to watch out for, and there were no reconciling items here, by the way, is in the theory. In the theory is based much more so on looking at the economics behind the assets that I'm transferring, looking at whether or not risk and rewards that relate to those particular items have been transferred. If they have not been transferred, then you don't get to derecognize. So it's not so much the case that legal isolation matters. Control, if you will, over the asset is less of an issue from an IFRS perspective. So there are going to be cases where you certainly will see differences pop out in terms of IFRS and U.S. GAAP in the area of financial asset derecognition. So certainly something to watch out for and highlight as being a potential area of difference. I think with that, Pat, I'm turning it back to you.
Okay. I'm going to move on to F-21 and talk about inventories, B.9. A couple of observations that I make with respect to inventory. Again, this issue of reversing impairments come into play. Under IFRS, you do reverse inventory impairments if the facts and circumstances dictate that you should do so. Also, a possible difference that we might have here is we know under U.S. GAAP we use a lower of cost market type of test. Under IFRS, it's a lower of cost net realizable value, which could be different, so we could derive some differences from that. Also, it wasn't relevant to this particular case, but for certain U.S. companies that might be converting to IFRS, LIFO is not an acceptable alternative to use for valuing inventories. Let me jump down to provisions on B.12 and make a couple comments there. And one of the things that DJ had mentioned early on comes into play here, some definitional types of things as to what is meant by the word probable. Under U.S. GAAP, in particular, when we think of FAS 5 and recording loss contingencies, we think about probable as being, you know, some high level of assurance, whether that's in the 70 or 80% range, but, you know, some high level of probability. Whereas under IFRS, they use the same term probable, but that term probable is actually defined to mean more likely than not, which means greater than 50%. So there could be differences, you know, based on that difference in the application of the terminology there. A few other things that may come into play when you think about, you know, at what level do you record a provision for loss contingency? Well, I think under both of the standards, we're sort of looking to record the best estimate. But there might be situations where you have a probable loss. That loss is only probable within a range, and no amount within the range is more likely than any other. And under FIN 14 here in the U.S., you would record the lower end of the range. Under IFRS, you would actually record the midpoint of the range. So that likewise could give rise to a difference here. Other differences could come up with restructuring. The tests aren't exactly the same as to when you would record a restructuring reserve. IFRS talks about a company being demonstrably obligated to a plan, which doesn't exactly line up with the same criteria that we would apply for restructurings here in the U.S., so we could get some timing differences as to when you might record a restructuring obligation. Another point is made in that footnote about recording obligations for legal environmental types of obligations that they have and for litigation, where amounts are going to be paid over periods of time. They're required to do discounting of those. Typically, we do not discount those provisions here in the U.S. unless we have some sort of a fixed terminable, you know, stream to do that with, but typically they would discount the long-term provisions under IFRS. Let me move on to I think I'll just focus on those areas where we sort of highlighted changes. So maybe if we move to F-23 on research and development expenses, not really anything new to mention here. DJ has already mentioned the point that under IFRS, it is acceptable if certain criteria is met to be able to capitalized development costs. Certainly that is not something that we would do here in the U.S. So that just comes into play again here in this particular footnote. I think with that, I'm now going to turn it over to Kathy to pick up on B.20 in the...
Great. Thank you, Pat. And so, yeah, we're now on page F24 and kind of highlighting through the areas. One thing I want to mention is we didn't really highlight any differences back on B14 with revenue recognition. Revenue recognition is obviously a very sensitive area here in the U.S. And as I sometimes hear people say, we have a couple primary standards, but mostly what the literature tells us is when we can't recognize revenue. Revenue recognition is very sort of principles-based in IFRS. There's really, one primary standard and another kind of ancillary standard that deals with IFRS, so there's a lot more kind of judgment that goes into revenue recognition. We didn't, notice anything that just wasn't explicitly a difference, but revenue recognition is sort of what we consider the epitome of a principles-based standard. And so it just is something that kind of always warrants a good discussion. There was nothing that just sort of jumped out, though, saying, this is absolutely a difference, so nothing was identified. But if we continue on here to footnote B20, and DJ had talked about this interesting subtotal within the statement of income, the operating income before restructuring impairment of PP&E intangibles and gains and losses and disposals, as well as litigation. Again, that's not something we would typically see in the United States, especially with an SEC registrant, because of the prohibition on non-GAAP measures. But again, really where the SEC was getting focus in is on the specificity of what exactly the subtotal is and really what it includes and, more importantly, what it does not include. So that's just kind of the highlight here, and we do sometimes see these measures under IFRS, but they need to be very transparent as to what they are. And then, moving down further in there on the impairment, again, just a constant theme, other than goodwill, if circumstances changes, impairments do need to be reversed under U.S. GAAP. Under IFRS as opposed to U.S. GAAP. So moving on to note B21, we have the discussion of financial expenses, and again, the impairment reversal theme comes through here. When it comes to financial instruments, you have to look at, kind of what the classification is here, and DJ mentioned this earlier, and focus in on whether or not, it meets those. One item that you are not able to reverse them is available for sale equity instruments, and so you got to kind of dig deeper into these sort of innocuous type statements that certain impairments are reversed. We want to make sure that they do qualify for being eligible to have an impairment reversed. So if we move on here to page F25, we're going to hit on probably everybody's favorite topic of income taxes. A couple things to, I guess, highlight here with respect to income taxes. As we kind of walk through the financial statements, we're going to focus in really on areas that where differences might arise because of differences between the FAS 109 equivalent, which is IAS 12, between that literature and 109. One thing that's really important to highlight, though, is that differences in deferred tax will also arise because of differences in other underlying accounting. As far as the tax models are concerned, they are actually the basic same underlying principle. They are a balance sheet liability approach focused on temporary differences and recording deferred tax assets or liabilities for differences between book and tax basis. But because of differences in underlying accounting, an example being research and development costs, you may end up with differences because certain items are capitalized versus expensed and how they're being recognized from a tax perspective. So that's something, while we're not going to kind of hone in on that here, you do see those differences in the reconciliation. And a lot of times, what companies need to try to do is the difference for tax, again, related to differences in the tax accounting standards or in other differences that arise. So just kind of focusing in here on some areas within tax accounting and real differences between the FAS 109 and IAS 12 models, the first here has to do with sort of what rate do we use to measure taxes. And two differences can arise here. If you happen to operate in jurisdictions where there's a difference between distributed rate or the rate you would use for profits that are distributed to the shareholders versus those that are undistributed and stay within the company, differences can arise. IFRS, as it currently is, does prescribe the use of the undistributed rate, whereas U.S. GAAP is a little more ambiguous, and typically what happens is companies use the distributed rate unless the undistributed rate is higher. So that can give rise to differences. And again, it's not something we typically see here in the U.S. because we don't have this rate differentiation, but when you're dealing with foreign companies and foreign taxing jurisdictions, that can become an issue. Another thing with what rate you use has to do with the concept of an enacted or a substantively enacted rate. And IFRS would tell you to use either the rate that's been enacted or substantively enacted, whereas U.S. GAAP would tell you to use the enacted rate. And really what focuses in here is in the context of the U.S., there really is no difference. Until the president signs something into law, he can veto it. It could change. But what we're really looking at is jurisdictions outside the United States, and England is an example of this, that the Queen is required to sign all laws or all of this type of legislation into law, but really she can't change it. So once it's gotten through the House of Lords, the House of Commons, it's generally considered what we call substantively enacted. And so the focus is in really are the remaining steps to make that law enacted perfunctory. So, again, outside the U.S., we can kind of come up with some differences here, but with the U.S. jurisdiction, this doesn't typically give rise. But we do sometimes see differences for this. The next item really is kind of a presentation issue, and that has to do with the presentation or recognition of deferred tax assets. In U.S. GAAP, we recognize, all our deferred tax assets, but then we reduce them by this valuation allowance. So to the extent it's more likely than not that some or all of a deferred tax asset won't be realized, we put a valuation allowance on it. IFRS takes a little bit of a different approach. They would just say you only recognize a deferred tax asset to the extent it's probable that it will be realized. And again, probable, again, a little difference in terminology, is generally meant to be defined as more likely than not. So really, we don't, the net effect here is that you really shouldn't get a difference. The net amount would be the same, but you do get a presentation difference and some disclosure differences because of this. And then kind of our fourth item here has to do with recognizing deferred tax assets and liabilities, or actually not recognizing them on certain temporary differences related to investments in subsidiaries, associates, and joint ventures. Under U.S. GAAP, we have a concept somewhat similar. They sometimes get referred to as the APB 23 exceptions, and these relate to sort of outside basis differences. So differences that typically arise out of undistributed earnings and things such as that, you don't have to recognize a deferred tax liability to the extent that it's sort of permanently reinvested or it won't reverse in the foreseeable future. It's a somewhat similar concept, but it's a bit more of a broad exception under IFRS. The U.S. jurisdiction, it has to be a foreign joint venture or foreign subsidiary, and under IFRS, it's a broader exception. It's for domestic and foreign subsidiaries and joint ventures, and it also actually covers associates. Typically, we don't see companies take the exception for associates because if you are able to control the reversal, this gets back to the consolidation issues. If you control that, it really calls into question whether you actually control the entity and therefore should be consolidating it, but again, it's a slightly different nuance. One thing I do want to kind of highlight with some of these differences here is there is there has been a joint project ongoing for several years here between the ISB and the FASB on income taxes. The FASB has sort of indefinitely put theirs on hold, kind of trying to figure out how to deal with convergence in light of all the SEC actions towards a wholesale, you know, conversion to IFRS. But the ISB is going to be moving forward with their project, and we do expect an exposure draft out. And some of these items, well, actually, I think all of these items will sort of should kind of move closer to, for these particular ones, move closer to U.S. GAAP. It's something we got to, you know, this as well as other standards, you got to kind of keep monitoring them because, you know, both IFRS and U.S. GAAP are likely to change in several areas in the upcoming years, and tax is one of those areas. One item, actually, while we're still on taxes, that we didn't highlight here, but is actually also just the classification in the balance sheet. IFRS would require deferred taxes, assets, and liabilities to always be non-current, where in U.S. GAAP we break them up between current and non-current based on the underlying classification of whatever asset or liability is giving rise to the temporary difference. The ISB is moving more towards the U.S. GAAP model on that, but as of now, that is a difference that we do often see. So moving on, we're going from one exciting topic of taxes up to pensions now and pension accounting, defined benefit accounting. In many respects, these standards are the accounting is somewhat similar, and in many respects, there are differences. And so kind of some of the specific ones that we highlighted here are have to do here on page F26 with this concept of an asset ceiling. If a company happens to be in a situation where their plan assets exceed their defined benefit obligation, under IFRS, they may be subject to a limit on how much of an asset they can recognize. U.S. GAAP does not have a similar concept, so that's something that students should highlight and be able to talk about where that can give a difference. And then kind of how we deal with actuarial gains and losses in how they're recognized. Here's the situation, actually, where IFRS provides a lot more optionality than U.S. GAAP, and typically actuarial gains and losses, you know, we deal with the corridor, deal with sort of the minimum pension liability, and we put it to equity, and we recycle it through P&L. IFRS actually gives you three options. You can recognize it all to equity, but you don't recycle it, so it's sort of sitting in this, the Statement of Recognized Income and Expense, or OCI, as it's actually changing this year. It'll be called Comprehensive Income. Or you can do the corridor approach, which we do under U.S. GAAP. Or you can actually recognize all amounts immediately in the P&L. So there's a bit more optionality, and so you need to look at, and students should be looking at what the company's policy is and what policy election they have made here. Another area that gives rise to difference oftentimes in the area of pension accounting has to do with past service costs. Typically under U.S. GAAP, you amortize, you know, if there's been some sort of change to the plan, whatever the additional past service costs is amortized over the remaining service period or life expectancy of the participants. Under IFRS, you have to really focus in on which part has become vested and which part is not vested. In any part that is vested, you would recognize immediately, and if there's unvested pieces, then you would take that over the remaining service period or life expectancy. So pensions is an area that, you know, you kind of have to focus in on a little bit, and there's also some issues with curtailments and things like that, but definitely an area, and actually it's quite interesting. There was a study done of 131 companies who adopted IFRS, And I believe the most identified reconciling item or difference actually had to do with pension accounting. So I think in the majority of companies in the companies that we looked at were working with Ohio State, I think all of them did have pension items in the reconciliation. And in fact, you know, Sanofi, if you go back and look at their reconciliation, had several adjustments, and one is related to the first time adoption, because you do have the option to actually recognize all your unrealized actuarial gains and losses to equity, which is, I will say, a very popular choice that many companies took, but it does provide for ongoing reconciling items if you're in that mode where you're having to reconcile. But again, pension's a very hot area or area of abundance of potential differences. So now let's move to B24 in share-based payments or stock-based compensation. And again, this is an area that we have standards that are fairly consistent, but of course, as we always like to say, the devil's in the detail, and there are definitely areas that can give rise to differences. And what one of them is a pretty basic difference is figuring out whether something is an equity settled award versus a cash settled award. And so that right there, you know, figuring out the classification can be, you know, so that really impacts the accounting treatment. So, and, you know, fortunately here we don't have a lot of information to really go into the details of these, but that is an area that can give rise to differences. A couple of the more noteworthy and differences or publicly noted differences have to do with this concept of graded vesting, it deals with when you deal with, you know, kind of issue awards that are not what we call cliff vested. So say I issue a grant of 1,000 shares and 25% vest after 1 year, 25% after 2 years, 25 after 3 years, and 25% after 4 years. That's, you know, the type of award we're looking at, as opposed to an award where everything vested after 4 years, all 1,000 options. For those that, you know, we kind of have these tranches, U.S. GAAP would tell you kind of have a choice. You can either, you know, kind of treat those as four separate awards and recognize the expense, you know, as if they're four separate awards, or you can kind of treat it as, you know, do the expense on a straight line basis over 4 years. IFRS does not have that optionality, and companies are actually required to separately measure the fair value of each of those tranches, and they don't always come out the same. You know, say it was $1,000 worth of expense, you wouldn't necessarily get four $250 grants because of differences in the expected lives and how you run the option modeling. So, you know, you can get differences in measurement, and then you have differences in how you recognize the expense. And so the effect is really front-loading the expense. You end up recognizing, like on that type of award I just, you know, mentioned, something where it vests 25% each of the 4 years, you end up recognizing over 50% of the expense in the first year because of this graded vesting. So this is one of the, you know, a very well-known difference and tends to give rise to GAAP differences. Another issue actually has to do here with B24.2, and that's employee share options or plans or ESOPs. Under U.S. GAAP, in many cases, ESOPs are not considered compensatory and don't fall under the accounting under FAS 123R. There is no exception in IFRS 2, so these plans are subject to accounting and will typically result in additional expense being recognized under IFRS. So, again, that's a difference that will likely arise. And another item, we didn't actually highlight it here because they didn't talk about the tax impact, but there's actually a significant tax impact here because of the way in which tax is recognized for share-based payment awards. In U.S. GAAP, the focus is really on what the comp expense that is recorded in the financial statements. So if I recognize $1,000 worth of comp expense and a 40% rate, I'm going to have a deferred tax asset of $400. And you don't adjust for any potential benefit or changes in intrinsic value. IFRS is a completely different model in that the deferred tax is based on sort of the expected deduction you expect to receive. So it doesn't really focus on what's recorded in the income statement. It's the benefit you would get as if you were to exercise those awards at each reporting period. So you're looking at if that option is in the money, you're going to have a deferred tax asset. If it's out of the money and therefore there's no intrinsic value, you would have no deferred tax asset. So this is a very significant difference between IFRS and U.S. GAAP, and one that a lot of people find a bit problematic because it makes it very hard to monitor and manage your effective tax rate because everything is contingent on where the market goes and where's the intrinsic value and what it is at each reporting period, which is something that obviously is out of the company's control. So enough of taxes and share-based payments. If we jump ahead here to item B26, which is segment information. As of right now, this company is following IAS 14 starting this year, or actually, 2008, the segment information or the segment standard will change. It will go to IFRS 8, which is very consistent with FAS 131. It adopts a management approach. So on a go-forward basis, I would, not expect to see any differences really between segments. And frankly, we didn't see a lot. I think a lot of companies try to sort of fit a 131 model into the IAS 14 bucket. I'm not sure I always got there, but a lot of companies did it. And, this new segment standard has been in the works for several years, and we knew where it was going. So a lot of companies didn't want to have a reconciling item for this, so sort of kind of fit a square peg in a round circle there. But on a go-forward basis, when we move past 2007, this difference will likely go away. Moving forward, there's B28 talks about new standards. I mean, that's very consistent with what we see in U.S. GAAP, having to kind of explain what the new standards are and any anticipated impact moving forward. With that, I think we've kind of come to an end of the B notes and some of the potential differences. We've covered a lot of differences, and they may or may not give rise to the level of a reconciling item, but I think it's a lot of good material that the students can bring up and highlight and discuss. And I certainly found that, at Ohio State, the students did a very comprehensive discussion of these potential differences and whether or not, they didn't, say it was a difference or not. It was more focusing on, kind of where the underlying accounting was and could it give rise to a difference. So with that, I'm going to, turn it back to DJ.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kathy. I guess a couple of kind of quick thoughts here, and then I'd like to open it up for questions here. We've talked about, on a pretty quick basis here, the most recent financial statements. As I mentioned before, what we posted to our website would be the 05s, which would include the IFRS 1 rec as well as the U.S. GAAP reconciliation. And I think as we've tried to flag along the way, there are a number of things in these financial statements, and this is pretty typical. I think if you looked at all the companies that we have posted on the website that we facilitated last year at OSU, it would be very similar in that there's a number of issues for you to talk about and to raise in terms of a lecture, in terms of kind of just understanding what IFRS is. As Pat said, this is not just differences, of course. Frankly, there's actually, I would say, trend-wise, fewer differences in relative terms with foreign issuers than one might expect, because a lot of those companies tend to look through U.S. GAAP in many respects as they applied IFRS, at least back in 2005. And so, again, depending on the policy elections that you have, you actually may not have that many differences. This particular company, if you look at their GAAP reconciliation, I would say that the vast majority of the more significant differences, at least, really had to do with transition to IFRS, not so much ongoing policy decisions. You know, a couple of exceptions to that. One would be development costs, which probably was the most significant difference, and then some of the things Kathy talked about in pensions. But other than those items, really the bulk of the differences initially were on transitional elections. And so that's one thing to, again, keep in mind in terms of these discussions is the focus certainly ought to be first and foremost on IFRS, and then secondarily on kind of what that means in a U.S. GAAP environment. Obviously, as Pat had noted earlier, in terms of this particular course, obviously we, you know, it was developed in the context of students that had a vast majority, if not all, of their U.S. GAAP accounting under the belt already. So we're trying to leverage off that knowledge in terms of, you know, what IFRS may or may not mean. Obviously, this kind of course may not work too well in terms of an environment where you're talking about freshmen, sophomores, and folks who have not had very much accounting guidance because they, you know, doing a comparison is not relevant for them. That wasn't the purpose of this course. So I do think keep that in mind as you think about rolling out this particular course. The other thing I would say is that in terms of just areas that we've posted, obviously the different sections, certainly if you wanted to incorporate into a course currently, different sections you could. One thing I would tell you is that, and I said this before, is that there are the vast majority of the areas that we're talking about technically have probably more convergence versus less convergence in terms of big picture, IFRS versus U.S. GAAP. So a lot of U.S. GAAP is already included in the current standards, and some of those standards aren't going to change. Some of them will change because they're joint projects, as we've highlighted along the way. But in terms of big picture, I would say there are four areas where we've got just very different approaches. Just to reiterate, one would be consolidation policy, which I highlighted. Two would be impairment, which we've highlighted here. Three would be provisioning under IAS 37. This is accrued liabilities, and we've touched on some of those issues. And then lastly, intangible accounting. If you look at those areas, consolidation policy is one of those joint projects. If you look at the exposure graph that came out recently in terms of the IFRS end, basically you're talking about maintaining a similar approach, and so U.S. GAAP will actually move potentially towards that model. So, again, you may want to think about that in terms of, if you, in terms of your courses. Asset impairment is not really going to change anytime soon, so that will continue to be a difference. Provisioning may change, and then intangibles is probably not going to change. So, you know, I look at this, you know, those four big areas of difference will largely continue, at least for the foreseeable future. And really, then it's getting your arms around kind of the nits, the little things here and there that that are differences. And I think Cash did a great job highlighting just the tax area in general as being an area where you've got a lot of things that have been nits along the year, over the years. That's going to change over time as well. But begin to get thinking about, again, those IFRS principles, the general concepts, the standards. It's not, well, certainly there's a lot of things here to chew on. I would say that the learning curve that we have in the U.S. is not nearly as steep as it was for certain folks in Europe. They really had to go, you know, simply go back to square one in terms of understanding the basic accounting framework. We don't have that problem here in the U.S. I think we're probably starting at square, you know, six or seven out of the scale of 1 to 10, if you will, in terms of how far along we are. So I think that keep that in mind as you roll out IFRS in your universities. With that, let me ask the operator if there are any questions that folks have.
Thank you. Once again, to ask a question, please press star followed by 1 on your touch-tone phone, and please record your name when prompted. Once again, star 1 to ask a question, please.
And while we're waiting here, one other quick point here, in terms of some of the things we're doing here at Deloitte with the consortium, obviously we very much appreciate feedback that you would have in general. Certainly on this symposium, we'll be sending out a survey to you afterwards. We encourage you to respond to that. We also certainly encourage any general feedback that you may have in terms of what your own needs may be, in terms of materials, education, training. Obviously, you know, we recognize as a firm that we have an obligation to work with the academic community to deal with these issues, to partner with you in terms of, you know, kind of dealing with this transition to IFRS, and certainly everything that we're doing through the consortium points to getting IFRS in the classroom, and hopefully what we've talked about today has been helpful. Hopefully the materials that you've had a chance to take a look at, and hopefully you will in the future if you haven't today, will be helpful for you in terms of beginning to get IFRS into your lexicon in terms of your university. Any questions, operator?
Yes, I have a question from Dave Campbell. You may ask your question, please.
Hi, Dave Campbell at Drexel University. We're just in the early phases, quite frankly, of developing a course that we're going to be offering in our spring quarter. I shouldn't say that far along in terms of early development, but we are selecting textbooks, da-da-da. I guess my question is, it doesn't seem as though this particular course, and by the way, we will not be dealing with master's level students. We'll be basically dealing with any undergraduates. And do you spend much time dealing with the conceptual framework from an IFRS perspective as you look through any guidance? It seems as though many of us in the U.S. are just saying, if it's not in the standards, we'll look at the framework and then we'll just go with U.S. GAAP.
I guess a couple of thoughts on that. Certainly, if Kathy or Pat have any thoughts to chime in, I do think one thing, and maybe didn't come out too much today in terms of our presentation, but certainly the focus on what I'll call general principles, the framework, what's an asset, what's a liability, come into the lexicon very quickly in terms of practical issues. I think of questions I've dealt with over the years in terms of complicated transactions, arrangements, contracts, and you're trying to think through, what is the right, what's the obligation a company has, which comes right back to the framework, what's an asset, what's a liability. So I definitely think emphasizing that right off, right from the start is important. I would say in general terms, the frameworks that we have under U.S. GAAP with the concept statements, the definitions of things are very similar, at least today, versus U.S. GAAP. And, of course, there is the ongoing convergence efforts in terms of the framework projects in general. Those have a little bit longer of a timeline on them. But, I think your point's well taken in the sense of, principles and concepts, I think, are what we should be emphasizing in terms of IFRS, and not just focusing on that's a difference or that may be different, and therefore you just kind of move on.
Yeah, and this is Kathy. I think if we look back at U.S. GAAP years ago, there probably was a lot more emphasis on the concept statements, and over time, the literature has kind of evolved away to more rules based. But I think in a principles-based environment and looking at the hierarchy and the fact that the literature cannot address every possible transaction, I think it's very important that they understand, the basic fundamentals and concepts. So I would think that would be, an important point to focus in on and spend some time on.
And this is Pat Turner, just to add a few comments to that. When I think about the course we offered here, we did not specifically spend much time talking specifically about the conceptual framework. And however, each of the topical areas we discussed sort of created some context for the principle that's being followed, which essentially went back to the concept statement to sort of create that context.
Yep.
Danny, am I still on the line?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. So the only reason I raised the point is I had I spent 3 years with another of the big four firms over in Europe, and there was a substantial pushback, as you can imagine, when we would be looking at IFRS and be looking at U.S. As a possible guidance. And I guess just a more conceptual question on my own, for those of you who are still in practice, how do you see this, assuming we do get IFRS here in the U.S., as we start looking at comparability and things like that?
But it was a good question. I think a couple of things here. One is, as we move away from the general model we've had in the U.S. over the years, which is much more detailed, I do hate this principles, rules kind of nomenclature because I think it gets way overused. But I do think that the difference in my mind isn't so much principles and rules. It's levels of detail and this mindset. And I think that, you're quite right. My experience in dealing with folks outside the U.S., Europe included, that would be one of, listen, we don't want to deal with the U.S. literature. We don't want to deal with the detail. I guess my perspective is obviously an accountant who's been trained in U.S. GAAP, maybe a little bit different in that, you know, the good thing about U.S. GAAP, if I can say it that way, is that, you know, there is detail for you to be thinking about, you know, what is actually happening in terms of a transaction, whether it's a revenue transaction, whatever it may be. It kind of gives you something to think about. Now, you know, having said that, I think you've got to frame U.S. GAAP in the right context in terms of IFRS, and certainly there's, you know, there's the ability, as we've said, to look through IFRS in a U.S. GAAP lens, or look through you know, U.S. GAAP literature and applying IFRS. My sense is that as we get, you know, more comfortable with this notion of IFRS, that mentality hopefully will change, in that we're not going to have this mentality of, and I think this is a cultural issue, and it certainly is going to be a challenge that will, I think, frankly, start with a lot of you folks in terms of training and education, is getting the mindset such that we're talking about principles first and not just gravitating in some paragraph and some detailed appendix to a standard that only five people really understand. And so, you know, right now I can tell you the mentality certainly is still, you know, well, let me find the answer somewhere. And I think we have to get away from this. It's not so much a research exercise, in my judgment, anymore. It's more of a thinking exercise. And I do think that perhaps one of the issues with that, ramifications from an academic perspective, is that we're going to have to think a little bit differently about how we approach teaching. Because I don't want to broad base, but I think for the most part, a lot of schools in our textbooks certainly are written in a way of, you know, here is a question, here's an answer. It's very objective, and you can you know, deal with that pretty easily from a management perspective. Now we're talking about changing the rules a bit and having people, you know, think through a concept in light of a fact pattern and get a situation. This certainly came up in terms of the OSU courses. People can disagree, you know, as to what something may mean or what something, you know, whether something makes sense or not. And I think focusing on that and the ramifications of that, I think, is what we should be doing to begin that cultural shift, if you will, in mindset. And, you know, that perhaps is the most significant challenge as I see it. I think, you know, I'd like to think that we're all smart people in the profession and we can read standards and figure them out in broad terms. It's cutting through that culture. And, yeah, I don't know, Kathy, if you have any other thoughts in your experience, but to me that's the biggest challenge here, is the culture piece, what you're talking about, what you're highlighting.
Yeah, and I don't think that can be underestimated. You know, working with some of our European clients, you know, we've been in this mindset, tell me where it says I have to do this, tell me where it says I can't do this, and you're like, wait, okay, let's step back and look here at the economics and try to figure out, you know, what we're trying to get at here. And that's a very different, you know, argument mindset to get into, and frankly, it's a bit of an uncomfortable, you know, it's a little more difficult to you know, have that conversation, but I think it's important that you know students as they're going through the program start to think in that manner, which is I think it's a kind of a fundamental shift.
Yep.
Well, I found your presentation very helpful, and I'm sure I'll incorporate more than a few pieces. So thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Do we have any other questions in the queue, operator?
I have none at this time. Once again, for any further questions or comments, please press star 1.
Okay, I've got a few minutes here before 3. I do want to thank, we'll wait here for questions, but I do want to thank everybody for their attendance and those that asked questions. Certainly also want to thank Kathy and Pat for their great presentations as well. I mentioned earlier, if you do have any follow-on questions, certainly feel free to work through the consortium website. We'd be happy to get back to you, you know, with responses. If there are any other operating questions that have come in here.
I do have one further question.
Oh, okay.
Mary Jefferson, your line is open.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation today and the materials you've made available. I'm currently teaching an IFRS course, and a question that I've quickly come across is that your materials and your sample slide decks are all in PDF form. Is there any option to get them in a more user-friendly form?
Good question. We can circle back with some of our tech folks on that, and see what we can do in terms of making available a more user-friendly format for you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the question.
Thank you. Our next question is from Dan Carraher. Your line is open.
Okay. Yes, I was curious, have you done anything to introduce the new financial statement formats that are being proposed by both FASB and IFRS?
Well, I think you referred to these a little bit earlier. Obviously, the discussion paper just came out, and as I said before, I think that we are going to see some pretty significant changes. We haven't, certainly in these materials, have not referred to those, although I would suspect over the next year or two, obviously, as we get farther along in the due process time frame, we'll begin to incorporate the new formats, if you will, into our discussion. But as of yet, I mean, we haven't focused too much on it just because it's not really been an issue that's been out there until recently.
Okay.
In terms of the documents.
Thank you. Our next question is from Marty Coe. Your line is open.
Hello. First of all, thank you very much for the presentation. Very informative. At the beginning of the presentation, you indicated that you chose to use resources that were available. Did you also consider some other books? You know, for example, Wiley has an IFRS book, and what kind of caused you to not go with the book approach?
I guess I can start out here. I don't know if, again, Pat, Kathy, have thoughts. I think the genesis behind this was trying to deal with kind of, and this was probably over a year ago now. It's almost a couple of years now, so the context has been a little bit different. I have seen some of the Wiley materials. I think the thought here was to leverage some of the things we've been doing as a firm in terms of experiences, and one of the things that we wanted to bring to this course was more of the practical aspects of this. And I think, with all due respect to some of the textbooks, you don't get a lot of that sometimes. But I suspect that may change over time. But I think here the thought was to try to bring a real life flavor to the materials, leaning heavily on the financial statements and case studies. And then I think kind of with that as a backdrop, one thing I always observe in practice is the need to actually focus on the actual standards themselves. And I think sometimes we get away from what's actually in the standards versus what's in some sort of textbook or some other book. And I realize there's a need for those things, but I do think that actually having the students read the words in the standards, I think, was actually very helpful in terms of a learning perspective. But I don't know, Pat, if you have any, or Kathy, if any.
Sure. I'll add a few comments to that. When we first started talking about doing this, of course, there really wasn't much available out there at all. And so there weren't a lot of, prepackaged materials to work with. And so, we had discussed the concept as to how we would put together this course. After having been through it once, I really like the way that it's worked out, and from a structure standpoint, that we are working with the actual standards and we are working with real live financial statements. I'm sure as time goes on, there will continue to be more that's made available in textbooks, and at some point we may make a transition, but I'm pretty comfortable with the way the course is going, at least now, of using the format that we have and the materials that we have.
Yeah, and I think another point, too, is, with IFRS, and you look at the entire volume of literature, it actually, the IFRS and all the interpretations, at least, issued by the ISB or the IFRIC, are in one book, which is completely different than U.S. GAAP if you just look at the volume of literature out there. And, I've heard comparisons of 25,000 pages to 2,500 pages. The volume of actual technical literature is so much less under IFRS that, when you start looking at, textbooks and things like that, we're probably, on a comparative size, looking at relatively the same volume of information.
Operator, are there any other questions in the queue?
I'm showing no further questions.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go ahead and call it a day there. I've got a minute or two before the hour, but once again, just wanted to thank everybody for their participation today. And again, once again, thanks to Pat and Kathy for their presentations. And we'll certainly be in touch, and we very much look forward to working with each of you. And certainly, if you have questions, let us know. Thanks very much.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.